Hey guys, I am coming to you this week live from the Delphi Resort in Connemara. So you're going to hear a lot of background noise because I have been trying my hardest to get this done and up for the weekend. I like to have this live on a Sunday morning, and unfortunately, the internet isn't so amazing in Connemara. The peace and quiet is wonderful, but I'm here. There's background noise, but that's okay. This week, I sit down with the amazing Louise Mulcahy, who speaks really openly and honestly about the heartbreaking loss of her husband, Peter, in a road traffic accident in October 23. They were together for 20 years and raising two small boys, and Louise and Peter were in the middle of building their forever home. Their life was full of plans and promise until everything changed in an instant. So we talk about the shock of sudden loss, the weight of grief, and what it means to navigate that while trying to show up every day for young children who are still trying to understand it all. This is a really powerful and moving conversation, and I hope that you guys will all take something from it. So I just want to quickly also remind you that, of course, this episode is brought to you again by the incredible Love Cherish. Maeve and her lovely team have the most gorgeous pieces, whether you're shopping for something special or just treating yourself. They're such a big support to this podcast, and without them, you wouldn't be hearing me today. So if you do head over for a browse, don't forget to use the discount code FLOWERS10 at the checkout. Okay, so hi, I am here with Louise today, Louise Mulcahy. It's so nice to see you.
And hi,
how are you?
I'm good.
We have met before because you were at one of my retreats.
I was.
Early of 24, was it?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was brilliant.
Yeah. So amazing. It was amazing to have met you like in person, and now we're here again today. Yep. And you feel ready.
Yes,
to tell your story.
Yeah.
So I am here obviously today to talk to you about grief and loss, mm-hmm. as everyone that comes here has their own, I suppose, experience of it. And for you, we are here to talk today about your gorgeous husband, Peter.
Yes.
So I'd love to go back to the start. So can you tell me the first time that you ever met Peter Mulcahy?
So me and Peter were always in the same like friend group.
Okay.
But he used to slag me so much all the time. I was like, does this boy hate me? You know, I'd only like walk into the room and he'd start slagging me.
In school?
No, just kind of in a friend group afterwards.
Okay.
So, but yeah, he was always very funny, just a nice person. And he worked away a lot, so he wouldn't have been around all of the time.
Okay.
Then we kind of became better friends and hung out a bit more. And I was in a relationship at the time, so we were just friends. And then that relationship ended, and I didn't think he felt any way at all. And then he just sent me a message one day saying, this is my opportunity because you haven't been single and I just want to tell you how I feel. So he was like, I really like you. I'd love something to happen. But if I would just like, if I don't say it now, I'll never get the chance. So it's up to you to like,
oh my
just
gosh.
Ignore it or do what you want to do. And I remember I was in college hairdressing at the time and I was like, what? Because he was just, I wouldn't have guessed
faint,
that.
Like?
Oh yeah, I wouldn't have guessed it. And then I said to him, we'll meet up tonight and we'll chat. And we had a chat and I still was a bit like, I don't know. I knew I did like him though. And then he said to me, tomorrow now I'm going to Vegas with my parents, so I'll be gone for like 7 days. I was like, what? You can't just drop that and leave. And then when he was over there, he was talking to me all the time and he still used slag about like how much the phone bill was because he was ringing me and texting me the whole time he was over there. Then he came back and I was like, yeah, I feel the same way. And it just, that was it then. And we knew everything about each other. It literally was best friends. And
so how long had you been friends before you started dating?
Oh, I'd say like 5-6 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a ballsy move. He obviously was quite confident.
He was always very confident, which, yeah, he never cared what people thought of him, and in the best way possible.
Yeah.
He just wouldn't care. It was ballsy, but it worked.
Very ballsy. And it's obviously that age old thing of where they're slagging you, but they really actually fancy you.
Yeah, I would say to him afterwards, I was like, it's actually so mean.
Is that your way of flirting?
Yeah.
Wow. So tell me, you went on, did you go on a date or did it just happen?
We went on a date. He brought me for something to eat. We went down to Washford. We went to a Thai restaurant and it was so weird because we were supposed to have been friends and just hanging out and going for a spin and stuff, you know?
So you're like, now how do I?
Yeah, I was like, this is strange. And Peter was always mad into his cars and I was as well at the time. So it was kind of that kind of scene where, you know, everyone hung around together and they all had cars, and that was his thing.
Okay, lovely. Yeah.
Loved his cars. Yeah. So that's what I was used to, going for a spin, you know. So going for food, it was very formal. But yeah, things just took off then. And
so you started going out.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And we were inseparable, like.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so then how did you make the jump from that to being engaged?
So, yeah, so we were going out for a good few years, and Peter unfortunately lost his mom in 2011 to breast cancer. So Peter was an only child, so it was just him. He was very close with his mom. So that was a really hard time for him. And yeah, we got through that and we moved in with his dad because his dad was there then by himself. So I suppose our relationship just, there was never a like, are we going to move in together or what? It just naturally happened. And
you're together,
that's what we did. Yeah, we were together in whatever we had to face.
Yeah.
And then like his dad was just that typical kind of, you know, older grumpy man. And we used to just have the best crack, like trying to, you know, mind him, but yet like stay out of his way. And, you know, we had the best laughs. But yeah. And yeah, we lived together. And then Peter worked away a lot. So he was in construction and he worked with a company called Sisk. So a lot of that was buildings that would have been in Europe. So he would have been kind of all over Europe for a time. And I was hairdressing at the time. So we then made a massive effort. I was still living with his dad, making sure he was okay. And then I would fly over at the weekends, wherever he'd be it Germany or wherever. So we made a real effort to always see each other and always be together. But like, okay, he slagged me because I had such separation anxiety. I couldn't cope like when he was away. I was,
really?
Yeah, I was so bad. Yeah.
So slowing it down then a tiny bit. So you obviously, it's so funny, isn't it, to think when you have that friendship before and you're obviously so deeply in love then.
Yeah.
If you couldn't even.
Yeah, no.
Pining for him when he was gone.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Yeah, completely. Like, it was like something was just, my left arm was missing. Like, you just, wow. Yeah, all of us together. And
and what was he like as a person then? Was he, what sort of character?
Calm. Really, like, calm and very black and white. Very, like, if you don't want to do something, you don't have to do it. Not a people pleaser. Very caring. Like, he absolutely took care of me. You know what I mean? Like, I just knew that no harm would ever come to me when he was there. I know that sounds strange, like I don't know what harm is meant to come to you, but he just minded me. He was a protector. Very quick-witted, like very funny, very funny. And in any situation, like however dark it would be, he would be the one to crack the joke, you know.
Okay.
You know, we used to slag him. He was so bad at funerals and things like that. He just couldn't do serious, you know. It was always fun. Everything had to be fun.
Hmm.
But yeah, just so loyal and always there. Like, listen, I would be a very bad overthinker and worrier.
Hmm.
And he was the complete opposite.
Right.
So he used to always calm me down, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like yeah. A lot of, yeah, I'd be like that.
Yeah,
like pure
yeah.
Overthinker.
And you can't help it if yeah. You're wired like that. And he knew that as well, you know.
But he wasn't wired like that.
No. And he knew then how to kind of calm me down and things. And yeah.
So you were a great match.
Yeah, a good match. Yeah.
So, yeah, so then after his parents, you moved in with his dad and then...
His dad passed away in 2017, yeah, he got COPD, so he passed away very fast, yeah. And at that time, we had just bought a house in Clonmel, only 20 minutes up the road, because he wasn't sick, so, you know, I couldn't stay living with his dad.
Yeah.
So we were like, we have to kind of get somewhere for ourselves. So we'd only bought that house the year before and then his dad passed away in 2017. And that was very hard for Peter, but an only child and to lose both his parents, it was really hard. So, but he was still the type of person that he wouldn't show you that he's suffering from it, you know, that kind of way. I just knew that it was a very hard time for him. And his dad died in April. And then coming up to Christmas, he was saying, we're not staying around here. Like, let's get out of here for Christmas. So we booked Dubai for Christmas. And, you know, all my friends were saying, you're going to get engaged now. But he was so laid back. I was like, lads, do not think that this is going to happen. We cannot take this as a cert now. And like, yeah, and even the way he did it, you know, we went to Dubai, we went up in the Burj and it was he'd book like the sunset time. And literally as the sun was setting, he just whispered into my ear, will you marry me?
Oh God, why are you making me cry already? Jesus.
And it was as simple as that. And I remember saying, what? And he was like, will you marry me?
That is so perfect.
Yeah, and that was him. It had to be simple. And you know, when we came downstairs afterwards, there was a guy on one knee and he was like, look at that fool. just wasn't his thing. Yeah. Yeah. So it was lovely. Yeah, it was really nice.
So you obviously came home then, a big celebration.
Oh, massive celebration. So all the girls were like, we were right. Yeah. So yeah, it was really good.
Okay. So when did you get married?
We got married in 2019. So because Peter's parents passed away, we wanted to go away and get married, and we wanted it to be like mostly friends, people we always saw. Mm. So 44 of us went over and yeah, got married over there, and we were there the week before. Our two best friends.
In Portugal, did you say?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, sorry.
Came with us the week before, Brona and Eddie, and Eddie was like Peter's brother. So they were best friends, and then his wife Brona, I'm her best friend. So
they,
so it was perfect. Yeah. So they came over with us the week before and we just relaxed and went out for meals, and it was just a lovely, yeah, a lovely time. And yeah, got married in the September, and yeah.
And so then when you returned home, you obviously had plans to make a family.
Yeah. So, you know, I used to always say to him, because I was like, when are we going to have babies? And he was very much, we have to get married now first.
Oh, yeah. So traditional.
So traditional. Wow. So we got married. I remember we were in the pool like the day after the wedding. I was like, so we having the baby then or what? And he said to me, we can have the baby. So, yeah. So I fell pregnant pretty quickly, and we found out that Christmas Eve that I was pregnant.
Oh, yeah, my God. Yeah, wow. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
Christmas, a really special time for you.
Yeah, it was. It was.
And so... Along came
Peter Jr.
Peter Jr.
Yeah, yeah. So he came around, and he came into the world and gave us all a massive fright, because when he was born, he wasn't breathing.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he was a forceps delivery. He was a big baby, like he was 9.5 pounds. So yeah, we got a shock start to parenthood. But yeah, he was a great baby though. Yeah, yeah.
And you're obviously thrilled with your love.
Oh, sure, we were delighted. Yeah, yeah.
And so, what was Peter like as a dad?
Absolutely, the best dad. Oh my God, so hands on. You know, like changing nappies, doing whatever. It was nothing to him. He just did whatever. You know, the feeds, getting up during the night. Yeah, he just want. He, as much as he used to be saying to me, "We'll wait till we get married," he couldn't wait to be a dad, and he wanted his own family. Mm. So yeah, he was thrilled. And
I was thinking that, like, when you were an only child and you blasted your parents, like, it probably meant so much to him to have his own little family. Like.
That's all he wanted. And he used to say to me, like, you know, we'll have to have another one, because he said, even for decisions and things, everything was left to me, and I wouldn't do that to another child. And, you know, not that it was his mom's, you know, his mom had to have a hysterectomy quite young. So that's why he didn't have any siblings. But for him, it was important that Junior did have a sibling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then along came
Arlo. Yeah. Yeah. So we had Arlo in 22. So Junior was just like 2 years, 4 months, I think, when I had Arlo.
When he was born.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Yeah. Oh my God. It was crazy. Yeah. But Arlo was actually a very quiet baby. So yeah, it wasn't too bad.
So, like, you know, so many people I speak to here, it's always just, you know, the dream scenario, even though I don't know, do people realise that at the time? I don't know. But, you know,
I felt like we did.
Did you? Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, the way, like, you'd always say, you know, if you only knew and you'd appreciate things more. I really felt so lucky. Yeah. And I know he did too.
You were happy.
We were so happy. Yeah. Yeah. And he was after getting a job closer to home. So he was after getting a job with a construction company in Carrickenshore, which was only down the road. And that's where his home house was. So he was around all the time, and yeah, he was just a great family man, you know. He just wanted us, that was it.
So in October of 23, Arlo was 11 months at the time.
Yeah.
And can you tell me what happened on that day, on the 5th of October?
Yeah. So Junior, we had started him in play school in Carrickenshore, because we had started to do up the home house and we were going to move back down there. So that was the plan. So we started him in play school, and he had just turned 3 in September. And yeah, Arlo was 11 months. So on that day, I brought him down to his little play school down in Carrick, which is about 20 minutes away. And it is where Peter's, where his offices were, where his work was. So yeah, dropped him in and was coming back with the baby. And Peter rang me. We were in constant contact. He could ring me 5 or 6 times a day. And he'd often ring me on the way home from work, and it would take 20 minutes. And he would talk to me. I'd be cooking the dinner. He would talk to me on the phone the whole way. And then he'd be like, right, I'm in the driveway here. I have to go into some queer one. Go on, good luck. You know, we just were constantly talking. So he rang me anyway to see how he got into school, and he was always slagging about junior. Like, you know, he'd only started, but you'd say to him, "What do you do today?" He'd be like, "Nothing." So he would say to me, "I bet you he's on the dag. He's going off on the dag." I had 3-year-old with all his little friends over the town. You don't even know, you know. So I was saying, I've dropped him in anyway, and we were chatting away, and he'd said to me, "You know that the tickets for Dublin Zoo, the wildlife, are out today." So I was like, "Great, I'll go on and I'll try to get the tickets at 11 or whatever." So just normal chatting, went back home, tidied up, like put Arlo down for his nap. Peter rang me again then saying, "Are you in the queue, you know, to get into these tickets?" So like we were just chatting. He was saying they had a meeting and work that morning, that the meeting had gone really well. And yeah, we were just normal talking. So I went back down then to collect Junior. He was finished at 12:15. And they gave me, they showed me a picture that Junior had done in school, and it was like a tree where they did all like their fingerprints on it. And they showed it to me. So as we were leaving the school, I brought my sister down with me actually down to collect him because I wanted to show her the new house. We'd only gotten the windows and doors in the night before. So I said, "We'll go and have a look at the windows and doors and I'll show you everything." Like Peter was thrilled like that we had the house finally sealed. So we were doing that, and then Peter rang me, and you know, I was saying, "Listen, I've proof that he's not in the dag because he did some work in school today." So he obviously turned up, you know, and he was laughing and he was on loudspeaker and he was saying it to Junior and the usual, like saying to me, like, "What's for dinner?" He would say that, you know, that'd be his thing every day. "What's for dinner? Give me something to look forward to." And I remember saying, "It's chicken curry." Like, and I said to him, "You know, the weather's not great now," because I could see like there was really dark clouds. I was like, "The weather's not great." So he said, "Yeah, I'm just coming from Cashel now. The meeting was really well. I'm going to go down to the offices in Carrick." And like, we literally were going to be going on the same road. So I said, "Yeah, that's perfect." And I said, I showed Gillian the house, you know, the windows and doors. And he said, "Sure, after dinner this evening, we'll bring the boys down. We'll go back down." So perfect. That was fine. So I said, and I remember I saying to him, "Right, so Pet," he's always called me Pet and I'd call him Pet. I was like, "Right, so Pet, I'll chat to you later." So got up home anyway and was there with Gillian. I made some lunch. And we were sitting and chatting, and then I could hear Junior saying to Gillian, "My daddy is so clever. He's after building us our own new house." So I remember writing a snap to him to tell him that. And I was poshing around the kitchen and my phone rang, and it was the play school, Junior's play school. And I was thinking, "Oh my God, did he like hit a child or something? She didn't want to tell me, you know." So I picked up the phone and I said, "Hey Lillian, like, what's up?" And she said, "Louise," she said, "there's a man ringing. She said, there's a Jason ringing from JSF Construction and he's looking for your phone number." And straight away, like, that would have been Peter's boss. And she said, "With GDPR, I can't give out your number. So maybe you'd want to give him a ring." So I remember calling Gillian and I said, "Gillian, something's after happening to Peter." And she said, no, you don't know that now. Just, you know, maybe he just wants to talk to you about something." I was like, "He wouldn't have went to that rounds like to ring the play school." Tried to ring Peter's work phone, tried to ring his own phone, no answer, which would be so unlike him. He'd always answer me. This was only 40 minutes after speaking to him. So rang, got Jason's number. I was Googling, trying to find it, got Jason's number, rang him. There was no answer. And then rang and got through. And he said to me, "Louise, are you on your own?" And I said, "No, I have the boys here." And he said, "Is there someone with you?" And I said, "Yeah, my sister's here. Why?" I remember standing in my kitchen just looking out the window. And he said, "I don't know how to tell you this, but Peter's after passing away." And I remember thinking, the first thing I said to him was said, "No, he didn't. No, he didn't." And it was this like, why would you tell me that lie? Like, I could not believe it. So I hung up the phone on him and I said to Gillian, "Get the boys into the sitting room." And I remember walking out the hall and walking out onto the road. You know, we were in a cul-de-sac and I remember it was like everything was in 3D. I could see, I was like, it was the most bizarre feeling. And I went across the road to my neighbour, and she's an elderly neighbour, but we always, you know, she was always great to us. And I was banging and banging and banging on her door. And she came out to the door and said, "Louise, what's after happening?" And I said, I gave her my phone and I said, "Will you ring this number back and tell him to stop ringing me, telling me that Peter's passed away? He's trying to tell me Peter passed away, like." So she said, "Okay, give me the phone." And I remember looking at her and I heard her on the phone and I heard her saying, "Okay, a road traffic accident," and speaking to Garda, and I collapsed onto the ground then. And the screaming, I will never forget the noises I was making. It was the only thing I can describe it is like when you're in labour and you're having a contraction. It was, I was just screaming no, like, and could not get up off the ground. It was like wailing. In my head, I wasn't saying, I was saying, whoever's after making this decision that he has to die, like, undo it. That's what I was thinking. Like, you fix this now, because this cannot happen. And I tried to ring his friends, and of course it's like at lunchtime, you know, people are in work and stuff. And I eventually got through to Eddie, and I remember screaming, and I was just saying, Eddie. And he said, Louisa, I'm on my way, because my sister was after ringing. And I went back into the house, and Junior was sitting in the kitchen, and he said, Mom, what's wrong with you? And I said, I fell, because I did not know what to say to him. And my neighbour came in behind me, and she said to me, Louise, we have to get the kids out of the house. So I said, okay, my mom and dad only live around the corner. So she took the boys, and I just remember feeling like the whole house was spinning, like it would not stop spinning. And I went into the bathroom, and I held on to, you know, the rads that are on the wall. And I was crouched down on the ground, holding onto that for dear life, because it was like nothing would stop. And the screaming, and, you know, Brona still says it to me, like, herself and Eddie came into the house, and she said, Louise, like, the screams out of you, like, she said, she said it was like an animal, like, she said, I'll never forget them. And she was pregnant. She, you know, she had my godson only like a month later. And I remember being on the ground and seeing her, like, she was wearing a grey jumper. And I remember seeing her bump coming down towards me. And they were crouched down, and they were saying, Louise, like, what do you want us to do? And I was like, I want you to tell me it's not real, is what I was thinking. I was like, this can't be happening. So I said to Eddie, I was like, you have to bring me. I have to see him. You have to bring me down to him. He can't be on his own. Like, you have to bring me down to him. So the neighbour, Therese, she said, listen, the guards have said she cannot go down. But try, because I wouldn't stop. I just kept screaming that I wanted to go down. So Eddie brought me out to the car, and he rang Peter's boss, and he was after being able to get down near the scene, and he told Eddie how to get down. And we were driving down the road, and I remember just thinking, like, there's no way he would have just died. Like, I couldn't, you know, he was a big man, broad man, and, like, always so positive, and I was the worrier about things happening, like, so this couldn't happen him, you know. I couldn't. So
he was so strong, and
he
kept you safe,
everything. Yeah,
so then you're thinking,
yeah, there's no way he'd be taken from me, like, and the boys, I was like, there's just no way. So we got down, and next minute we could see the guards, the road closed, and they were turning people away. And I remember looking at Eddie and him starting to, like, deep breathe and panic, and I remember thinking, oh no, this is bad. Like, it was kind of as if I didn't even think it could have happened. And I'll never forget, like, it was a young guard, blonde hair, and I remember Eddie saying, this is Peter Mulcahy's wife. And I remember the look on her face, and she said, just pull in there. And she said, we're going to send the sergeant up that's down at the scene. And I remember sitting there, and I said to Eddie, like, they're not going to leave me down. Like, they're not going to leave me down to him. And Eddie said, well, if they're not going to leave you down to him, there might be a reason, you know, so we'll just see what they say. And it took ages. I felt like we were sitting there for so long. And then we saw the sergeant come driving up, and she came up to the door. And firstly, she gave his date of birth, and it was wrong. So I just want to confirm. And I was thinking, it's not even him. She's the wrong date of birth. And then I saw his boss coming behind her, and I was thinking, he would have known the van. And the reason he rang me is because Peter's van was printed, like, and it was a local van. So people had already, it had gone around that there was a big accident.
Could you see the van?
No. So it was miles down from where the checkpoint was.
So that's, yeah, so your brain is still going, maybe it isn't him.
Maybe it isn't him. And as she was talking to me, you know, and I said this to her afterwards, like, she was talking in the window, and she had her arms up in the window, and all that was going through my head was, if I belt open this door, will I get her off the door so I can run, so I can get down to him? Because she was telling me, you know, we can't leave you down. And I remember thinking, like, could I take her to get her off the door? That's all that was going through my brain. Like, you have to leave me down to him.
So what did she say to you after the date of birth?
So she said, Louise, we have him in an ambulance now. And she said, we're taking him off the road. And she said, there's no point in you going down there seeing that. He's not there now. So I said, I don't want him on his own. I don't care if he's in the ambulance. I don't want him on his own. And Jason said to me, Louise, the fire brigade that are down there are the Carrick Fire Brigade, and they know him. Like, so as it happened, Peter's one of his best friends and longest friends was a firefighter, and he was working that day, and he was one of the first people down there, and he didn't leave Peter's side. He stayed with him. So once I knew he wasn't on his own, and normally what would happen then is that they'd bring somebody down to Waterford Hospital. But she said to me, I'll bring him to Clonmel. So I'll bring him up to the morgue in Clonmel. You go home.
So did she confirm to you that he'd passed away?
Yeah. Yeah.
She said that to you?
Yeah. I still didn't believe it though.
Did you not?
No. No. I just, no, I didn't. I remember thinking, you need to leave me down so I can sort this mess out. Because someone's after really messing up here. So she said, go back home, have a cup of tea and, you know, we'll call you. And when I got back home, sure, the house was full of people. And I remember even thinking like, why is everyone here? Like,
yeah,
why are you all here? Because like,
get the fuck out.
Yeah, like nothing's after happening. Like, so they rang to say that he was in the morgue in Clonmel and that we could go up to see him.
What do you do with that information? Like,
yeah,
it's bizarre though, isn't it?
Absolutely. What that does to you, it, like, you can't comprehend that. Like, to be talking to somebody and within an hour and a half of that, you're going to see them in a morgue. Like,
and your kitchen is full of people.
Yeah.
And your kids are gone. And
yeah. And the one person that you want to ring and say something really bad's after happening here is him. He fixed everything. So on the way up to the morgue, then we got up there, the guard, like, you know, the guard of van was there, the ambulance, and I could see the sergeant and I could see Peter's boss, and I got out and I remember thinking, I'll go in now and see, like, there's no way he's actually dead. That's what I remember thinking. I was like, I'll go in and I'll see, because they've no clue. And I remember it was the only time that when people say you float, I remember floating in. I cannot remember feeling the ground under my feet. And I remember as I passed the guard, she said to me, Louise, do you want someone to go in with you? And I was like, no, I want to go in by myself. I want to go in and see him by myself. But my God, like, nothing, nothing can prepare you for that. To see him in a morgue on a slab. Like, I went in and, you know, he was still warm. And I remember I just sat down and I was rubbing his face and I was thinking, he's going to be really worried about me. That's all I thought, because that was what he did. He worried about me, the boys, once we were okay. He used to always say to me, I don't care what happens in life, once my family under my roof are happy, that's all that matters to me. So I remember thinking, okay, Louise, he can still hear you. So, you know, they say spirits hang around like 40 minutes. That's what I kept thinking. So he can hear you and he's going to be worried. So I was talking to him and I was saying to him, you don't have to worry. I'll be fine. I will be fine. The boys are going to be fine. I'm going to finish the house in Carrick. I'll get him to school. I'll do everything we said. Like, don't worry. And like, I remember, yeah, like, just kept talking to him and saying, like, you know, I know you didn't want to go. I know, like, but it's okay. Like, and then the guard came in. Like, they're obviously standing there because of the circumstances. They don't really leave you fully on your own. And she came into me and she just put out her hand and it was his wedding ring. And she said, just want to give you his wedding ring. And I remember thinking, that it? Like, is that it? You just handed the wedding ring back. And yeah, and I remember saying to her, I don't even know how you got that off, because he actually like hit his hand in something and work, and you know, like, it bent down so it wouldn't come off his finger. And he used to always say to me, you're delighted now. I can't get the ring off. And I remember saying to her, like, oh, I don't know how you got it off. And yeah, and she said to me, we're going to need, like, just, yeah, like, to give you his things. And I was like, okay. And she said to me, Louise, will I get a priest? And I still was like, for what? Like, and she said, you know, do you want the priest to come down and give him his last rites? And I said, yeah, will you just ask Eddie, does he want to come in to see him? And I remember Eddie coming in and putting his hand on his shoulder and just saying, it's all right, lad. Like, and I remember looking at Eddie as if to say, like, this cannot be real. Like, this cannot be real. And they got the priest down, and I remember the guard saying to the priest, like, you know, Louise has two young boys. She's an 11-month baby and a 3-year-old at home. And I remember saying, like, looking at him as if say, yeah, like, no clue, like, what it had meant, like, what had just actually happened. So she said, we're going to take him to Waterford now and, like, we'll take great care of him. And that was it. Like, you were left float back out of the morgue into the car holding his wedding ring. And, like, that's all within the space. Like, we went up to the morgue at, like, 3:30. Like, his accident was at 1:20. I'd only spoken to him 40 minutes before that. Like, so one afternoon was all done, all gone. Everything. Yeah. It's, yeah, it just, and I remember going back down home and like that, like aunts and uncles and neighbours and everybody was there, and my girls, like my friends were there, and I just, I was screaming, I was getting sick, I just couldn't, you know, to think that he was just gone like that. You know, and I remember wearing his hoodie and like even looking at his side of the bed in the room when I was going back in to get stuff, and I was thinking like, he can't have left this morning and given us all a kiss and just be gone. Like, it just can't be possible.
It's pure disassociation, isn't it? Like, as in,
completely,
your brain can't catch up.
Can't, no, no.
Your body probably feels it, and that's yep. why. How have I no tissues today? Fuck's sake. I can't. I always You're have fine. A box there. I forgot. Do you need me to get some?
No, I'm fine, I think.
But yeah, it's like your body feels it. That's why the scream comes out.
The screaming, yeah. So your body knows, but your mind is thinking, he'll be home for dinner, sure. He knows it's chicken curry. And we're going down to the house tonight to look at the windows and doors that were only put in yesterday, that he was so thrilled about. And that was so cruel. I felt like he got to, you know,
yeah.
like it just, yeah. And of course, I thought, like, you know, you see it on the telly or you see it on a soap, that I thought I'd be told what happened.
Yeah.
I thought, like, they're going to come down to my house now and there'll be a team of guards and there'll be other team that's going to help me with the kids and they'll tell me exactly what happened. But they don't. And that night I was down there, the house was still full, and that same sergeant, and she's a lovely woman, came to the door and she came in and she said, Louise, I have his wallet and I want to give you his wallet. And I remember saying, I just turned to her and I said, what happened? And I remember her looking at me as if to say, oh my God, this girl thinks that I have answers. Like, and she said, Louise, we're not going to know what happened. And she said, it could be up to 12 months.
So you had no idea?
No idea. Nothing. No idea. So my brain had gone from chatting to him on the phone, been told he died, to seeing him in a morgue, because I didn't see Anthony on the road. So in my head, I was like, but how did he die though?
What happened? Yeah.
And they can't tell you that, you know. And even now, 18 months on, I still don't have his post-mortem. Like, I still couldn't tell you what killed him.
Wow.
Yeah, the system is so hard to take. That is so hard.
And so, obviously, you then start to rely on hearsay and people that came on it.
Yeah, and the road was open for a little while. And the other part of that that has really, like, hurt me and my family is, like, people videoed it, you know.
Oh my God.
And I know people do that and they don't even think, or they don't think someone has passed away, but, like, there was videos going around of him and he was such a private person, and I just thought, like, well, someone was taking their final moments, someone was videoing it. Yeah. And I also was jealous because they got to see what I wasn't allowed down to see.
Yeah.
You know, it was the strangest thing. So his accident was on a Thursday and they kept him in Waterford until the Sunday. And I remember saying, I want him home. I want him brought home. And, you know, like, his friends were like, we'll do whatever you want. So whatever you want, we'll do. And, you know, we laugh about certain things that, like, your mind goes into this place that is just beyond, you can't even, you know. I remember saying to Brona, like, I wonder, will they put him in the bed for me, you know? And
yeah.
Brona was saying, of course they will. They'll do whatever you want. And I remember Eddie saying, Brona, wind your neck in, like, we don't know. Don't be telling her things that we don't know. And she was saying, but we'll do
that's
it.
That's what I'd be thinking.
Yeah, yeah. She was like, whatever you want, wherever you want him, we'll put him, you know? So they kind of sat me down and they said, Louise, it's okay bringing him home, but the house was small. And they said, like, this is going to be a very big funeral. Like, you're not going to take that crowd here. But in my head, I was like, I don't care. I don't care if no one comes to see him because I want him here. So what we did then was we brought him home. He was home on the Sunday night and we just didn't put it on RIP, so we didn't tell anybody. All of his close friends, like my family, we were all there. I stayed with him the whole time. I didn't leave him at all. And then on the second night, we said what we'll do is bring him down to the funeral home in Carrick for 2 hours. And then I said, I want him brought back home again. So, you know, they were slagging, saying, you have him up and down the road, you know. And I said, I don't care. And I remember even coming out of the funeral home and people looking, and like, he was put back in and brought back up the road. I was like, I'm keeping him. you're not bringing him to any church now yet. So, yeah. And those two nights, like, I chatted to him and he looked perfect. He'd one tiny little bruise on his cheek. Other than that, he looked absolutely perfect.
What goes through your mind at that stage? I suppose you understand that he's gone.
Yeah.
But when you're there with him, it's obviously still shocking.
Absolutely. I fully believe he was around me and he could hear what I was saying to him. I do believe that. I did want him to just wake up. I was staring at him and I was still thinking, this couldn't have killed him though. Look, like, there's not even a mark on him. And I remember like saying when we were down, and you have to go down and you have to pick the coffin and you have to pick all these things. And I remember saying, he was meant to get a haircut on Saturday, like, can someone cut his hair? And I remember them saying, yeah, like, we'll cut his hair. And but like, when it's an accident and something like that and they're doing like a post-mortem, it's a lot more in depth. So like, they had like obviously opened his head and like all the staples, and I remember feeling them and thinking, like, that would really hurt. Like, you just, your brain, you know,
you're thinking that's hurting him.
Yeah.
When it's not.
And like, he loved watching like Brooklyn Nine-Nine. He used to watch that when he was going to bed or whatever. And like, during the night, I put that on my phone and I like lifted up over the coffin, and you know, I was like holding it up over him, like, and I think of that now and I'm thinking, he must have been in the room somewhere, but like, oh my god, she thinks I can see it. And I remember, like, I had his like aftershave and I kept spraying it and I kept saying to the girls, like, I don't want him smelling like a dead person. He wouldn't like that. Like, he'd want to smell like himself. And you know, they were saying the funeral home, like, they were choking on it because I know
the humour in there. Yeah. The fact you can laugh at that.
Yeah. But even like that night, I remember the first night he was there, Eddie like set up the chair, like the chair beside me, because he was in the sitting room. And he was saying, Louise, now, like, don't lean on the side of the chair because you lean on the coffin and this, that, and the other thing. And so I stayed with him all night and chatting and everything. And then like the next morning, Eddie came in and he was like, Louise, I literally like was lying on him. So I was able to, like, I figured that if I sat, I was able to sit on the side of the armchair and I was able to put one arm in under his head and one arm around his chest, and I slept like that on his chest. So like, I was leaning on the coffin, and I remember saying to Eddie, oh, like, once or twice now it did like give a swing, and he was like, oh my god, you cannot be trusted to stay with him on your own. Yeah. And
so when did you tell the boys? Or did you? Because they're so... Well, obviously, Arlo was a baby.
Yeah, this was the biggest thing. I did not know what to do.
Yeah.
I did not know if he would have wanted them to see him in the coffin or not. And for the few days before he came home, that was the biggest debate in my head. And all I kept thinking about was, we were at a funeral when I was heavily pregnant on Arlo, and it was a young man that had kids, young kids. And they were at the funeral and they were so upset. And I remember Peter turning to me and saying, I don't know, should them kids be here? And it kept staying in my head. And I just thought to myself, you know, he was the dad that like brought Junior swimming every Saturday, that like they went up to Woody's and they went to Screwfix and they did all the bits and bobs, and he was down the house working. And he'll want Junior to remember that. He won't want Junior to remember seeing him here. So I made that decision. And also, like, I was gone to Cuckoo Land, so I couldn't be a mother to them for the mass, or like, I was literally being held up. And I just thought, that's not fair. Like, they would need my full support. So they went out to like my brother-in-law's family, which they looked after them so well, and they would have been familiar with them. And what we did at the time was, we got a friend of mine, Emma, she came up with a lovely idea. She said, why don't we get four teddies? So she said, like, you know, two identical ones that we'll put with the boys and that we'll put with Peter. And for the few days, you leave them in the coffin with Peter, we leave the boys, have the other two, and before Peter's buried, we'll swap them. And that's what we did. And they sent me loads of photos of them holding the teddies, now playing with the teddies, and Peter had the two teddies with him the whole time. And yeah, the morning of the burial, we swapped the teddies. And yeah, I remember like the night before then, when he came back from been down at the funeral home, you know, me and my sister laugh about it now because my sister stayed in the front bedroom and I was saying to her, like, I'm trying to think of all the things I need to put into the coffin with him, you know. And I remember Eddie saying that coffin was a lot lighter last night. I was like, okay, we'll put in obviously photos, and I wrote him a letter. And it was 4 or 5 pages long. And, you know, I was saying to my sister, he hasn't even got peace now that he's gone. He's going to have to read this letter, you know. And I put in the jumper I was wearing the night before because we'd gone down to the house and stuff. And then I remember saying to my sister, I said, will you go out and get the kitchen scissors? And she was like, what do you want that for now? I said, I'm going to cut off a bit of his beard and a bit of his hair. Mm-hmm. So she was like, okay. So she gave me the scissors. I remember cutting his beard and thinking, oh, that's probably a bit much. And then, like, I cut like a piece off his fringe, and she just said to me, just as well, he was in the funeral home tonight. It wasn't last night. And then I said to her, like, what else can I put in? Like, I don't want to forget anything. And just real fast, she said to me, why don't you cut off some of your hair and put it in with him? And I was there with the scissors, and then I was like, oh no, that's not a good idea. I won't cut my hair. Yeah, and did all the things I could think of doing. And I played him the songs that we were going to play at the funeral, and I really wanted to do a eulogy. I wanted to be able to do that. So I wrote that and read it out to him like over and over. And our song was The Cook's Naive, and I just kept playing it and playing it and just really spent the time with him. I knew once he was gone, that was it. And that moment when they come to take him, that was the hardest moment because I knew he was gone then. And I remember them saying, like, Louise, do you want to go in when they're closing the coffin? And I said, I can't do it. So Eddie and his best friend Emmett, they went in. You know, when Eddie said to me, I promised him I'd look after you and the boys, and like the lid went on the coffin, and even Dara, you know, the funeral taker, like, he's young as well, and he said, Jesus, Peter, like, this is 40 years too soon, you know. And I remember him being carried out of the house and the screams out of me because I knew he wasn't coming back, and like driving behind the hearse going down. And I remember, like, and the road we're driving up and down now is the road where the accident happened. And I remember thinking, like, how am I behind my husband's hearse? Like, this is not happening. And it was a massive funeral. And like JSF, the company that he worked for, you know, they did a guard of honour, and like there was hundreds upon hundreds of people there. And I did the eulogy. I don't know where this rent came from, but he did. And you know, it was a lovely mass. And yeah, and then we went up, and as we came out of the church, Dara, the undertaker, he said to me, Louise, why don't you get into the hearse, sit in the front of the hearse, and it'd be the last spin with him, like, and you go in with him.
That's a nice idea.
Yeah, and it was lovely, and I never would have thought of doing that. Yeah, and we got up there then, and like, you know, he had so many such good friends, and the shock for all of them that he had so many people that wanted to carry the coffin. We had to take turns and like switch it out. Yeah, and then it was the burial, and I remember afterwards, you know, Eddie said to me, are you okay to go up here now? And, you know, because obviously the after is part. And I said, yeah, I'm fine. Like, I think I need a drink. Like, I want to have a drink. But like that feeling when we drove away of him being left there, like, considering I had separation anxiety anyway, if he was even gone away. Oh my God. And I remember we got up to Clonmel, and I remember walking in, and there was hundreds of people. And all I was doing was looking for him. I was looking at the bar, and I was looking, and I was saying, like, where is he? Like, and I turned to Brona and I said, I can't do this. Like, I can't stay here. So she said, that's fine. We'll go. What do you want to do? So I went back down home, and I went in, and I put on his hoodie, and I put on a tracksuit pants, and I said to her, I have to go back to him. Like, I have to go back down. So she said, that's okay. We'll go back down. And we went back down, and I laid on his grave. I remember lying down beside, and they were still filling it in. And I was lying there, and I remember, like, the poor men filling it in, and they were looking at me. And I said, I'm really sorry. I don't want to get in the way, but, like, I just don't want to leave him. And he said, you're okay, girl. You stay there. You're all right. And I remember he came over, and he just, you know, held my hand, and he said, it's okay, like, you stay here. And I did. I stayed there until they had it all filled in, and his flowers, and I just didn't want to leave him. And I said to Brona, I need to get the boys back now. And I remember her saying, are you sure you want to do that now? And I said, yeah, no, I need to get them back. So this was still the day of the funeral, and we went up to the house, and I said, Junior has to come back first, and I have to tell him. So they were worried, was it the right thing to do, because it was so fast. But in my head, I needed him back. You know, I needed to feel my family back or something.
But he was physically a part of Peter.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's like...
So then it was what I was going to tell him. And I suppose I thought about it so much, I kind of knew. And like, when this happens, they give you leaflets, you know, they give you leaflets on what you're not to say to a child. So, you know, you don't say they're ever going to come back. You don't say that. You make sure you say, like, for Christmases and birthdays, you'll still not have your daddy. Like, all these things you don't say. You don't say that they were sick, they were near a hospital, or, you know, but no one tells you what to say. Nobody tells you what to say. And, like, I know no one can tell you exactly what to say, but if there was some sort of support to just help, because all I kept thinking was, I don't want to make this worse than it already is by something I say to him, because he's never going to forget it. Mm. And I remember they brought him back, and sure, he's only three, like, and the little face of him.
Full of life.
And he came in, he was like, Mommy. And the kitchen was full of my friends, and we closed the door in the kitchen, and I said, Junior, you come into the sitting room with Mom. So he came in, and tell me, normally, like, three-year-olds are busy playing around. I sat him on my lap and I said, Junior, Mommy has to tell you something now, okay? And like, he stared into my eyes, like, as if he was looking into my soul. And he said, what, Mommy? And I said, Daddy had an accident and Daddy had to go to heaven, okay? And he said, okay, thinking like heaven was the shop. And I said, that means we're not going to see Daddy ever again, because he has to stay in heaven now. And he said, well, why would he stay in heaven? And I said, because when you go to heaven, you can't come back. So I said, it's just me, you and Arlo now. And I'll never forget the look on his face. Because I felt like I had done that to him, you know, because I had told him. And the pain in his little eyes. And I said to him, you know, I'm after getting this book and it's The Invisible String. And I said, I can read it to you. And I said, you know, Brona's in the kitchen and Eddie and all my friends, and he's like, I want to go out. And I'll never forget all of them standing there and pure heartbroken to see him walking in and thinking like he's just found out his daddy's gone. And it was getting dark, and you know, I said, look, we'll go out and see if we can see a star, you know. But like, foolishly you think that that is the conversation, but it's not. We've had the conversation nearly every day since, you know, asking. Yeah. And in my head, I was like, once I tell him, I've told him.
But that's not the case.
Not the case at all, no. And they have both really suffered in the past 18 months. And especially Junior, like, he had this thing every evening where he had to go see the star. So he'd say to me, Mom, will you bring me in the car? And he would ask me again and again then what happened. And the tears would be streaming down my face, and I'd be trying to, like, keep it together to be able to answer him. And then he slept in with me, and he slept on my chest. He couldn't fall asleep unless he was on my chest. And I remember crying so hard that I was trying not to wake him. And Arlo was only a baby, so he was in the cot beside me.
The loneliest place to be.
The loneliness is just to have your life literally ripped away. That's what it was like. It was like everything ended, and it was like you were abandoned in this world you knew nothing about, but you had two babies that were absolutely dependent on you. And for me, it started a lot. Like, I suffered a lot then with panic attacks, because I was learning to not leave myself. Like, you can obviously get upset in front of them, but not to the point where you're falling apart, because they get frightened. So I was teaching myself not to show it. And then by holding it in, it was bringing the panic attacks on in my body, because obviously there was just so much been kept in. and the panic attacks started getting really bad. And Junior kept saying to me, like, "Mom, like, you're not going to go to heaven though, are you? Because then we'll have nobody." So I started to get like really like bad health anxiety and started thinking like, oh my God, if something happens to me, they have nobody. I have to be okay here. Like, but like just never be able to speak to Peter about it, or, you know, like just, and even just for the communication to be gone, we would text each other constantly, 5 and 6 phone calls a day. Like it just, yeah, I just...
It's unimaginable, like that, the silence.
The silence.
It's so painful.
So painful. And to not know what happened, or it was just, I couldn't fathom it. And I remember weeks after, I said to my liaison officer, Mary, and like, she has been brilliant. And I remember saying to her, I have to go and see his van. I have to see it because I can't fathom how he would have died. Like, there wasn't a mark on him. Like, he was invincible to me because he used to be telling me, like, nothing's going to happen. Like, everything's fine. And she said, you can. You can go see it. Like, the guards will have to be there. You can't touch it, but you can see it. And I remember my family and friends been really concerned. Was it the right thing to do? But for me, I'm the type of person that I have to have all the details about anything in life. I just have to know everything. And then I can, you know, deal with it or whatever.
And put it to rest, kind of.
Yeah. And, I remember Eddie saying, do you want me to come with you? And I said, yeah, if you can come
that,
with me.
That part of it, I mean, not the whole thing.
Yeah, but exactly. That, just to put the piece together.
Yeah.
And I remember going out in the car that morning and I remember saying to Eddie, it's not going to be as bad as we think though, because we think it's so bad. I was thinking like, there can't be anything left of it because that's the only way he would have died. And he said, yeah. And then we met the guards and she said to me, you can walk down around, I have to stay standing here and you just do not touch anything. And I remember walking around the back of the van and everything was perfect at the back of the van. And I remember coming around to the front and I just fell down. Eddie caught me before I fell onto the ground and the screaming, and even Eddie, which, you know, a man like never gets upset, and he was saying, oh my God, like the poor man. There's just no way he would have got out of it. Like, there was no way it. And as painful as it was the first time that I thought, yeah, that is why he died, though. Because he couldn't have got out of that, like.
Okay.
It's
interesting, yeah. Isn't it, that, like, people would worry about you in that scenario, but, like, for you, it probably...
It helped me.
In a weird way, helped
it you. It did, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you needed to
close I needed to see it.
Question in your
yeah.
head.
Yeah. Because to me, like...
What happened?
What happened? Yeah. And
just popping in for a quick word. We've only a handful of tickets left for the Grief and Wellness Retreat happening Sunday, April 27th in the Savoy Hotel in Limerick. It's a lovely, gentle day with bits like journaling, seated yoga if you fancy it, and a chance to connect with others who get it. Most people come on their own, but you're more than welcome to bring a friend, sister, whoever you feel comfortable with. If it's something you've been thinking about, now is the time to get your ticket, and you can get it on griefireland.com, and I hope to see you there.
You know, when I remember then I saw his coffee cup and his lunch bag, and I remember saying to her, I want that back. Like, you know, and they went and they looked through, like, to see if they could get it, and they did. And I remember her bringing it in to me, and
so good.
Yeah, and
maybe it's a good moment to say that we do know that there was another car involved.
Yeah. So there was another car involved, and it is an open investigation, a current open investigation. So legally, I'm not allowed to talk about exactly what happened.
Yeah.
But it's only in the last few weeks that I know what has happened.
Mm-hmm.
So there has been 18 months of no clue.
Mm-hmm.
And like, within those 18 months, I didn't know. Was it instant? Was he waiting for help? Was he in pain? And like, those things haunted me. I was thinking, like, was he trying to get to his phone to ring me? Yeah, it really, like the questions. And obviously it's a road that we drive. As I was driving the road each way, I was trying to figure out, like, what could have happened? Like, what could have happened for him to have been killed?
What's that like passing by?
Horrific. It's absolutely horrific. And of course, Junior was in play school down there. So I was driving down still, bringing him to play school. And I couldn't even drive. I used to be that upset. And I remember my friend saying to me, Louise, like, you need to move him to Clonmel. And like, but because I'd gone to the morgue and I'd promised him that I would do all these things, it really affected me that I'd change the plan because I promised him, you know. And it was only, Brown had said to me, do you think if this was the other way around and this had happened to Eddie, like what would Peter be telling me to do? He wouldn't be telling me that I have to keep going up and down the road torturing myself. He would tell me to do the easiest thing, and the easiest thing is to change him to Clonmel. And I did that. And of course, the house is still left there, you know. The windows and doors went in the night before and it's still the exact same.
Really?
Yeah. It still has to be finished. I just can't even stand in there, you know.
But it's only been 18 months.
It's still so fresh.
That's nothing.
No, like. It's nothing. Yeah. No. And I suppose now it's just processing what happened is the main thing for me. And it's funny because it's like having two lives because you're grieving every single day. You wake up and your heart is just, it's an actual pain in your chest. But then you have these two boys that are like, they have their birthday parties, they have Santi, they have all the things. And like, those things are so sad. Like, they're horrific. Like, Christmas was horrific. You're there prepping for Santi by yourself. Like, you know, it's just the loneliness and the pressure and the sadness. It's so bad. And the sadness for the boys. And I remember we went to see Santi and we went with my sister and my brother-in-law and their little fella, Brandon. And we went to see Santi. And afterwards, we were having a coffee and Arlo, which he's two now, and it was the first time he ever said it, and he turned to me and he said, "Mom, where's my daddy?" Because he saw all the families going in and out and all the daddies for the pictures, and he just looked me straight in the face and said, "Where's my daddy?" And Junior said, "Daddy's in heaven, remember? We don't have a daddy," because that's what Junior says now. And even recently, they're getting ready because Junior's starting school in September and they're doing the preparation for the graduation. And Junior has suffered with like panic attacks since, and they've both suffered really bad with separation anxiety because obviously Peter went to work and never came home. So still to this day, they have to be in the bathroom if I'm having a shower. If I have to go do anything, I have to do it when they're in school. So even if I wanted to meet my friend for an hour, Junior would be in such a state, he wouldn't be able to breathe like if I was leaving the house.
Oh my God.
They're that terrified.
That's so hard on you.
It's hard. So it's just trying to deal with that. And then yet, you know, he's there crying about his graduation, saying that like everyone in his class has a mommy and daddy going and he doesn't have a daddy. And I said to him recently, like, I can ask somebody else. Like, I'll ask somebody, who would you like to go? And he said to me, can you get me a new daddy? Can you get me another daddy? And I said, I can't. And it's that not being able to fix it for him. So eventually he said to me, like, Brown and Eddie are his godparents. Sure, I asked my goddaddy. And I said, yeah. And he said, that'll be funny because the kids in my class don't know I have an Eddie, you know, because he's thinking, like, I don't have daddy, but I do have a goddaddy.
An Eddie.
An Eddie. Yeah. And, you know, we'd say, like, he knows that Brown and Eddie are there and, like, my sisters. And, like, I have such a great group of friends, like, all the girls, and family. I wouldn't be here.
Only They've farm. Still stood by you.
Oh my God, yeah. True, everything. Yeah.
That's amazing. And like, so you're lucky, you know.
So lucky.
Some people don't, well, you're not lucky.
No, but.
Do you know what I mean?
In that sense, though. In that sense, like, yeah. I've been so up and down, you know. Like, they could come in one day and I'd be like, I am selling everything and we're moving to Australia and I'm never going to see any of you again. You know, I'm doing a new life. And then they'll come in the next day and I'd be thinking, do you know what tiles I was thinking for the utility in Carrick? And they're like, oh my God. They used to always say, like, we didn't know which one, who we were coming into, but we didn't care, like, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the saddest part is the boys and Peter not been here. He would hate that.
Yeah, I know.
He'd hate that. And there's no, you can't say, but still, or but, nothing.
There's no, at least nothing.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, he felt so strongly about Junior not being on his own.
Yep.
Never in your wildest dreams did you think he'd be gone.
Never, ever, ever did I think that he'd be gone. And for me, I've had to become kind of tune into the way he used to be, because I can't go around worrying all the time now. I can't, because I'm the only person now that can look after them. So like the strength I get from, like, in any situation, I'd be like, what would he say? Like, or what would he do? Or, you know, and that's just what I try to do. But it's a long road. Like, they're only two and they're only four, you know. There's a lot ahead. I can only just literally day by day, you know. It's all I can think.
Yeah. How did you get help with the panic attacks? Did they...
So I started going to counselling. So I found, like, a trauma counsellor. So she is amazing.
Really?
And, like, I go every week. It helps, yeah.
It's helped with the panic attacks?
It's helped with the panic attacks. I did have to go on medication in the end.
Yeah.
So they had to put me on, like, antidepressants and sleeping tablets. And the thing is, at the start, they wanted to put me on sleeping tablets, but Arlo was still waking, like, and he still was wanting bottles. I was like, I'd love the luxury, like, to be able to knock myself out, because that's what I want to do, but I can't, because these kids, like, need me. And they were so sick in the first months after. They say that grief does that, but I was up in A&E with them all of the time. So I couldn't even think of taking anything like that. But luckily, I have a really good GP, and the counselling, like, is really after helping, yeah. And now that I have some answers, I think those were the things that were keeping me up at night. Like,
just for anyone, I suppose... I do hear it, but I do know as you're talking, I'm thinking of someone. But with the panic attacks, like, what? How do they manifest? What's it? I've had panic attacks in the past, so I know what a panic attack is.
Yeah, but it could be.
It's physical, ferocious.
It's horrific. So for me, it was the simple things. Like, if I was making lunches for the boys, and I'd be thinking, oh my God, I'm not making Peter's lunch. I'm never going to make lunch for him again. And then I'd be like, oh my God, I can't breathe.
Spiral.
Can't breathe. And I couldn't breathe. I wouldn't be able to catch my breath. And, you know, it, in the middle of all the bad ones, like, my mother so many times were like, someone needs to get her a doctor, get her a doctor. But my brothers would be very like, just leave her be, you know, and they'd sit beside me. And I remember one really bad one, and I kept saying to my brother Brian, like, he has to come back, he has to come back. You know, he has to come back. And that's how I felt. I was like, he has to come back, like, because I can't do this. Like, and it's so hard for anyone that's watching that. Like, and I remember at the start, for the first, like, definitely 6 months, when I'd start to panic, I'd have to go down to the grave, which is 20 minutes away. And I remember even ringing my friend Sarah one night, and it was like 11:30 at night. And I said, Sarah, my sister's here with the kids. Like, I have to go down to Peter. Like, she said, okay, stay where you are. I'm going to drive you down. And I remember lying on the grave at 11:30. And I remember she had, like, the light on her phone, and she was holding my shoulder, and I was just sobbing and sobbing. And I just kept saying, like, he has to come back, you know? And I kept thinking, like, if anyone was to ever come back, it'd be him, because he fixed everything, you know. And, like, myself and Brona often said it, like, you know, we'd be really good, like, problem solvers. And we were like, why can't we fix this? Like, no matter what we do, no matter what comes back or what happened, or it's done, like, it's done. There's no fixing it. Yeah, there's no fixing it.
Yeah, it's like a full body rejection, isn't it? It's like you're no.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
The hard part is, like, eventually you have to, you have to accept that they're not coming back, and that's really frightening to do that.
Terrifying.
Yeah,
and that's how I would describe how I have felt all along. Is just terrified.
Yeah,
and terrified of anything, and, like, even, like, I'll constantly look for reassurance and double checking things, and, like, because. It's like you're bracing yourself for something really bad to happen again. Because I was caught such off the hop, like, that I'm like, you know, and even if someone tells me something, or even my friends, like, I'd be saying, like, I'm so sorry that I've been like this or whatever. And, like, you sure you still want to be around me? Like, or, you know, checking things all the time, which must be so hard for people. But it's like, yeah, it's just like this, just been terrified that something bad is going to happen again.
Yeah.
You know?
I get that.
Yeah.
You're just waiting for the... someone described it, actually. It was these... a lovely girl. They have a charity called Jacinta's Smile. And they lost 3 siblings.
Oh, my God.
And at different stages. But she's explained it one day. She said it felt like she was bracing for impact the whole time.
Yep.
Just waiting for the next thing.
Yep. And that's exactly... I feel like sense. I'm still in that.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting.
Yeah. So you live in fear then?
Yep. Constant fear. Yeah. And there's no escaping that, you know. You, like, yeah, I don't know when that kind of starts to like thaw out or whatever, but it hasn't happened yet. And I think it's also the fact that you're a mom to two small kids that it's worse, because nothing can happen to me. Like, you know, yeah. I have to be okay.
You're terrified.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And you're also in kind of a limbo in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, time is kind of frozen, because you also have to presume there's going to be an inquest.
Yep.
Yeah. And then there's the whole other side of things.
Yep.
And so you kind of have to wait, because
that's all
there's still things to come.
Yeah. And I'm so terrified that I will go backwards. You know, you think you're making progress and you're like, I can't go back to the darkness of that. Like, but you, like my, as my counsellor said, you can't make yourself act a certain way when this happens. Like, it will happen, and whatever way you'll deal with it, we'll deal with it. But it's just, yeah, it's trying to, and even no one wants to hear the injuries. Like, no one wants to hear what he suffered. Like, I want to know, because I need to know, and I want all the answers there for the boys, and I want, when they're older, to have every shred of information that I possibly can get for them. But I don't want to sit there and listen to what he went through, because he was the kindest person and always just looked out for everyone and cared for everyone, that like, he just did not deserve that. Like, you know, and no one deserves to die at the side of the road, like, nobody. But yeah, if it's a thing, like, if whatever he suffered, it was too much. He shouldn't have suffered at all, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just preparing yourself for hearing things that I've no clue what it is going to be, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, no doubt it's going to be horrific.
Mm.
But perhaps in a way, like the van.
Yeah.
It'll give you the answers.
Yeah, to try heal.
Not the injuries, but, you know.
Yeah,
the,
just to be able to put it all together.
Find out what happened.
Yeah, and then
it's so
heal.
So important, that, isn't it?
100%.
Like, it's so, I think people underestimate what loss can do.
Mm.
I suppose when it's not the natural order.
Yeah.
You know, the loss of a child or an accident, and it's a multitude of things. You have suicide, you have murder. There's so many ways. Road traffic accidents are so brutal.
Yeah.
So, you know, even those little things that, like, as you said, on their own, the side of a road, like the things that you have to cope with and deal with. And, you know, when people have disease, you can't control that. You can't do anything with that. And it's just as ferocious in ways, you know, people are ravaged with illness. There's something about when there's questions to be answered.
Yeah.
Because we know, you know, a lot of times with disease and things like that, it's just, it is what it is. It's a biological thing,
like
a heart attack or whatever.
Yeah.
But when there's questions left, or it wasn't supposed to happen.
Yeah. It's
awful hard to deal with that.
Awful hard. And especially when you are an overthinker and a person that needs to know all the information.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that part, and just the whole process, I was so naive to it. I thought, like, you find these things out, if not instantly, like within a couple of weeks. And I remember the guards coming to my house just before his month's mind. I think it was like 2 weeks afterwards, and him saying to me, it would probably be just after his anniversary. And I remember thinking, like, oh, his month's mind. Like, I was thinking, okay. Yeah. And he said, no, Louise, like, his year anniversary will probably be just after that, by the time this process is after. So I remember saying to him, so I won't know what happened until then. And I remember saying to him, just answer me, because he couldn't answer anything. And I remember saying to him, just where I'm placing his flowers on the side of the road, please tell me, like, I'm putting them in the right place. And he said, yeah, you are. And that was all. That was all the information I got. Yeah.
It's like, I'm kind of worried, like you a little bit, I feel. Like, that would drive me insane to have the answers.
Yeah.
Like, there and then. I'm like, I don't care if you don't tell me, I'm going to find out somewhere else. I need to know.
Yeah. And my mind, you see, will just keep trying to figure
stretching,
it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was coming up with everything.
The toll that takes on, literally on your mental health.
Oh.
It's...
Yeah.
Something people don't understand or realise.
No. And I just don't, like, only for I have those two boys, I don't think I'd still be here. And that is the God's honest truth. That's how dark and hard it is. Like, at the start, like that, when you're up every night, you're not sleeping, you're not eating, you can't. Like, I'd lost loads of weight. I just remember just looking myself in the mirror and I was like, who is this person? Like, and the pain of it, and the not known, and like, it only for like everyone arriving into my house every day, I'm like, here's dinner and we've done this and we'll just get through today now. And like, you know, what else do we need to do? What do you want us to do? We'll do this, this and this. And then I'd concentrate on what I had to do, and that would bring you, you know. And my sister Niamh, she'd always slag me. She'd say like, I'd know when I come into the house because I was very much distract. So I'd be like ripping a cupboard apart, and like she'd sit down. I'd be saying, there's no time for sitting down. We've so much to do. You know,
you're like my sister. She used to do that. Yeah. I'm like, what on earth did she do? Yeah. She, for context, she lost her husband.
Yeah.
But she'd be like, I'm going to paint this room now. And I'm actually going to put carpet down upstairs. Yeah. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
And then she was demented. We were like, what are you doing?
That's exactly the way I was.
Distracting herself.
Yeah.
Sure, whatever gets you through.
That's it. And my sister, to be fair to her, she'd just get in and muck in then. She'd be like, right, come on, so what are we doing? And then the next day I'd be like, I'm so overwhelmed. Like, I can't take on all of this stuff, like rearranging all this thing. And she'd be saying, yeah. And I'd be saying it as if it was someone else's idea. It was literally me yesterday. So yeah, like trying to keep up with yourself, like,
yeah,
is just, yeah. But I do feel I'm coming out of that, you know. I don't feel it as intense, and I just keep trying to think, like, he would be like, it's okay surviving, but you need to live now, you know what I mean? So I try now to see if I can get out for an hour or two with the girls, and, you know, plan things with the boys where we go to the zoo and different things, and just try my best to live. But like, it's so hard. It's so hard. And every single thing you do, you're thinking, he should be here. He should be seeing this. Or, you know, even things like you bring them somewhere and you're taking the double buggy out of the back of the car and you have the changing bag and you're trying to make sure where you're after parking, and then try to, like, I used to keep thinking, like, there's two against one. Like, what am I going to do? It's two against one. And, you know, we used to always say when we had Arlo, oh my God, like, this is hard going. Like, we didn't think it would be this hard. And I remember sitting at the grave being like, what am I going to do? Like, you know, you thought it was hard and you were here. Like, what am I going to do with these two kids by myself? And yeah, and as they get older, that'll get easier. But yeah, you feel like you're wishing their little lives away then as well, you know.
I know, it'll get easier. But then with that comes their understanding.
Their grief, and when they actually will fully understand, and they're going to have all the school shows, the learning to drive, the Debs's, the weddings, like, oh, everything, every single thing. And he was such a good dad that, like, the life, I can't give them that. Like, I can't, you know. And I suppose that's taken me an awful long time in counselling. I was trying to give them the exact same life, as in be both people for them, and so they wouldn't feel the pain. And I remember them saying to me in counselling, like, you can't do that because he's gone and it's horrific, but they need to know that, like, you can't be two parents. You are a single parent now.
So when you have children, your number one priority is to keep them safe and make sure nothing hurts them.
Yep. And that's what I...
And you have to walk in, break their heart, give them that news.
Yep.
And
keep reminding them that, like,
no one understands how hard it is to go in and break a child's heart.
Literally.
Your own child's, which you never want to break.
No.
But you have to... I'm not saying that you did, but do you know what I mean?
But yeah, it's me.
You deliver that news. It's just painstaking, like.
It is. And it's only getting worse for them as they're getting older in that sense, because the more they realise, you know, and like that, the little graduation thing. And
do you have people then chiming in? I know you've spoke actually about the amazing sport you have, like, it's just fantastic, like, long may it continue. They're obviously very tuned in people to understand that you need that support.
Yeah.
But in general, would you come across people kind of saying, ah, sure, you know, they don't feel it, and, you know.
Oh, listen, the things people have said, I could write a book. And it's just people try, and, you know, people at the start used to keep saying to me, God, aren't you lucky you weren't all with him? And I was thinking, oh my God. And I remember saying to somebody one day, I said, no, because then we'd be all dead and it'd be better because we'd be all gone. And I remember my sister being like, Louise, you can't say that.
Yes, I can.
I was like, I'm sick of people, you know. And I remember one night Arlo wouldn't settle. And I was walking him up and down the road in the buggy, and there was this woman, and she came out and she said, my God, she said, you are so strong. And, like, I don't ever swear. And I remember I turned and I said, I have no fucking choice. Because I was literally like, who's going to put him to bed? Like, you know. But yeah, people will, like, most people will think and say, oh, whatever about Junior Lee Starling, now has no clue. And he's always known that his daddy's gone and this person is gone. And Junior fully knows. And they fully feel the heartache of him just been ripped away. Like, they still, and they'll say goodnight to him every night. We're in bed, they'll all say night, Daddy, and love you, Daddy. And Junior will say, I wish Daddy was here and I could see him. I just want to see him. And all I keep thinking is, if Peter's hearing him say that, like, it's horrific, you know. It's just, it's cruel. And you can't, and I went through a phase of saying, you know, Daddy's here, you just can't see him, like, you know. And then the counsellor was saying, you're trying to take his pain again. You're trying to take the pain away. And he used to say he's missing Daddy, and it has to be really hard. That is horrible, but he has to feel that.
Yeah.
You know, because I remember, like, I changed the car then, because I had this thing that, like, if something happens, our car is quite, like, low down. I want our new car to be a strong car. And I remember when we got the car and he was saying, yeah, and we've still no Daddy to sit in the other seat. And I remember saying, no, Daddy's there. You just can't see him. Like, he'd love to be in the car. And, you know, and I remember afterwards being like, you need to leave him have that moment of Daddy's not here, and it's really crap.
Okay, yeah.
You know, but it's so hard. You don't know what to do. You just want to make it better.
I understand what you're saying too. Like, I obviously haven't lost my husband, but, you know, I suppose going back to when my sister died, just for any new listeners, my sister and her husband died. And so then we had the kids.
Yeah.
So we had to kind of do what the job you're doing.
Yep.
And tell them, deliver the news. And, but it's just interesting as you're talking there, I'm thinking, yeah, like I did that one time. Like, I took my nephew swimming and he said, I wish mom, and he was three at the time when they passed. So he was saying, I wish mommy could see me swimming. And I said, she can.
Yep.
She's looking down. And I never forget, he was about four at the time. And he said to me, sure, how can she see me? There's a roof. And he was so shocked, as in, how can she see me? Yeah. She's not looking through. She can't see through the ceiling.
Yep.
I was like, oh God. But now that you're saying it out loud, I'm like, it's also important that, I suppose it would be a bit like grown-ups when we say, but at least he's in a better place now.
That's it.
You're stopping.
Yeah, you're stopping.
You're not allowing
feelings
the person
valid
to grieve.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I never thought about that in terms of kids.
Because you just think, like, you just help them and make them. Make
you're
it
thinking
better.
Like, oh, sure, you know, I didn't mean that, whatever.
Yeah.
And then it puts you into the person's shoes of an adult who doesn't understand it, saying something silly like that.
Like, you know,
like as in, they're there with you all the time.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you're like, they're not.
Yeah. Or people say to me, sure, like, you're a young girl, you can live another life, you know, and you're thinking, what are you talking about? Like, you know.
I know, but adults should know better.
Yeah, I feel like it's an Irish thing sometimes to just make it better, you know.
Fix it, fix
it. It could have been worse, you know what I mean? And people say, like, you know, plenty of people have gone through it, like, you'd be fine, or you're strong. Like, you know, that's really irritating me to start to say to my friends, like, if someone says I'm strong, like, I have no choice.
I know.
Like, I have no choice. Either be here and go through it, or I don't be here. I have no choice to be strong.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to be strong.
I know.
And then my friends, you know, they said to me, like, yeah, but there's a difference. Like, you're still trying. That's probably what people mean, you know, because I just take so offence to, like, being called strong.
I know. And I used to too. But then I feel like I've gone back to doing all the cliched things. Sometimes I'm like, you're such strong people. And then I'm like, stop.
I know.
Fucking say that. You know, you can't help it.
Yeah, you don't know. And it goes back to the whole, like, cleaning and rearranging the house. Like, someone could say something to me one day and I'm like, oh, sure, God love us, that was so nice of her. And then someone could say the exact same thing and I'm like, what?
Why would you say that?
Yeah, I don't know my own mind half the time. Like, that's literally how it feels. It's mad. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you do certain things, like, to keep Peter's memory alive with the kids? Or your own little things now?
We do. So, like, for his birthday, we still had a birthday cake. We had a party. Everyone came up and lit the candles. And Peter was obsessed with his birthday. Like, loved his birthday. Loved the presents. And balloons. We leave off balloons for every, like, occasion. And, yeah, like, you know, his clothes are there. And we'll talk. I talk about him all the time. All the time. There's never a day we don't. And even if I go away, like, with my friends, I'll talk about Peter all day because he's part of my life. So, like, if they say, like, oh, remember such and such, I'm like, oh, that's like the time myself and Peter went. Like, I've never stopped talking about him. I find it so much easier to talk about him. I find it so strange if I meet someone and they don't talk about him.
Yeah.
I find that's harder because I feel like people are nearly afraid they're going to remind you and upset you, and you're thinking, I haven't forgotten. Like, I can't forget.
It's bizarre, really, isn't it, how we, they still, as you're saying that, I'm just thinking, like, Peter still is.
Yeah.
Full stop. Peter is.
Yeah.
Like, he's still.
Yeah.
Real.
He's still real. He's was here. My husband, the dad.
But it's this sense of, like, okay, that's that done now. Let's not talk about it ever again.
Ever again. Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's mad.
Because then it really holds someone back from their grief and everything too. It's like, you're not seeing someone where they're at.
Yeah.
Like,
and
allow them to.
Allow them to. Yeah. And I remember for his first anniversary, I felt like the funeral was obviously, it goes the way the funerals are meant to go and you kind of have this order of doing things. And I remember saying, like, I want to celebrate his life. Like, I want a celebration of his life. And that's what we did. And we had it at the house and Peter adored his barbecue, like loved barbecue. And I got the guy that like he always went to get like all his like steaks and burgers from and he barbecued and I put like pictures up everywhere and I had like his hard hat and everything out. And I got like all his friends around and we just shared memories and we got a memory book to write memories in there for the boys when they're older. And we just laughed about him. And like, he was so funny, like, and the things people were telling me and stories I'd never heard. And that was important to me, like, to keep him alive like that, that like people will keep talking about him. And, you know, yeah. And even at that, and even when I'm talking to you now, I still don't believe he's gone. Like, it's mad.
Of course not. It's no. So recent.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny because people, so then you then 5 months into it, you come to my retreat.
Do you know,
how
yeah.
did you do that?
Do you know what it was, right? Because the way I think, I needed to find people that were surviving. Because I couldn't find anyone that had survived. Like, as in, because it's such, been a widow at 36. Like, luckily, you don't find other people really that are that age that are widowed. So any widows I were finding were probably in like 60s, 70s and had older kids. And I kept thinking like, yeah, that's okay. But I don't know if some, if I can, I don't think I can survive this. And I remember like Peter's accident was the 5th of October. And I remember saying to my liaison officer, like, I am so badly struggling. And she knew about your podcast. And she said to me, you know, listen to the podcast. And I remember on, I think it was the 29th of October, Diane's podcast went out and she had lost her husband. She was a similar age to me and they had an 8-month-old baby boy. And I remember listening to that and weeping and thinking, somebody finally gets how I feel. And I sent it to all my friends and all my family. And they all listened to it and they then understood me so much better. So I reached out to Diane then and she had told me that she had gone on a retreat and not as early on as me. But also I felt like I didn't have time to grieve because I was been a mom all the time. So I just wanted that night away as well. Like those nights away to just think about Peter. And like on the retreat, like it's amazing. Like the people you meet and I got to see like people survive this, like, and that there's people there that are in a club. No one wants to be in this club. Like nobody asked for this life, but you're in it and you get through it and you'll survive it. And that is the thing. And that retreat helped me no end. Like it did.
But the thing about it is like, I feel so strongly about them. I think it's so important and I see what happens.
Yeah.
And since then, since the one you were on, I've done two actual widow retreats.
Retreats, yeah.
Spousal loss.
Yeah.
And you would be blown away at the age profile of people. Like they were all in their 30s, 40s, couple in their 50s, one in their 60s, all young.
Young.
And I went for dinner with them. They're one of the groups. Those two I did. And I, one of the groups, we went for dinner. Like, you've no idea. Like, there's a girl who's 30. They were just building a house. There's a girl in Scotland, husband had a heart attack
so sudden
in her early 30s as well. Both of them didn't have a chance to get that far to even have kids. And but they connected because they were kind of happy that she was like, oh God, like when she came into the room and everyone told their stories and she was saying, I thought I'd be the only one here with no kids. And then she was like, oh my God.
Exactly. This is the thing. You make connections with people. Yeah. And I remember on that retreat, a girl came over to me that wasn't much older than me and she'd lost her husband really suddenly as well. And she said to me, I look at you and I remember being like that. And she said, like, you will be okay. You will be okay. And I remember we went on that walk like through the woods and she just was telling me like, and I remember coming home thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be okay. Like, I'm going to be okay. But I remember on that retreat, I was coming back on the Sunday and it just goes to show, like, I took that to have the time to myself to think about Peter. And I was coming down the road and my sister ran me and she said, Junior's got chicken pox. And I remember thinking, here we are, we're back into motherhood. That's the grief on your own over with. So I was so grateful I did take that because obviously eat chicken pox, that went on for 10 days and Arlo got them. So like,
it's a scary thing to do though, but so good on you for doing it because people do get really scared.
People get really scared and I would just, oh my God, push past it because like when you really get there, you're held.
No one
asks you to tell them what happened. Everyone's just there and like everyone knows that everyone is after been through really bad pain, like, and has lost somebody. And
but I was thinking as well when you're saying there that, you know, when that girl come over and says you will be okay, no one else has the right to say that to you though.
Exactly.
Because no one can understand it, and that's yep. what I keep saying is that you
unless you
have to meet someone who yep. gets it.
Yep. And even me and Diane, like from the podcast, like we will
I love that,
voice note all the time.
Yeah, I love that.
And like it could be silly things to do with the kids, and it could be just things that you come up, and like obviously, you know, she went through the same process that I'm going through, and she has advised me, like, you know, with the inquest and how it hit her, and like, you know, things that might help me. And, you know, we're going to meet up this summer now, and the boys are all going to meet each other. And,
delighted.
You know, it's, yeah. And I, like, only if I listened to the episode, I never would have met her. So, like, yeah.
No, it's great.
I just hang on to her, and, you know, she'll say to me, like, I remember at this stage, and this is how I felt. And I'd be thinking, that's exactly how I feel. Mm. You
and
know?
Of course, she met three other ladies on the first retreat. They're all really good friends.
They're still really good friends.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing. And, sounds like I'm blowing my own trumpet because
no, but
I
it
know
is,
that,
and that is my
but
story.
I believe in that. I believe it is amazing and it's incredible because people need that.
Yeah.
They have to find someone else.
Someone else, and that someone that gets their pain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Otherwise, but then you do go back to reality, and then you're back to the loneliness and the isolation. But if you could have someone on the other end of the phone that gets
That gets it. Like
helpful.
That, like Diana's a single parent now, you know, I say solo parent now because it's just, it's easier to say. It's easier, yeah. And, you know, with them being sick and this and the other thing, and yeah, it is so nice to have somebody that can just.
I'm glad that you guys have found each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, you know, it's very early days, I feel, for you still.
Yeah. There's a big road ahead. But
there is, yeah.
He'll help me, though, and he'll guide me, and I truly believe that. Yeah, and I think it's time now to try and live a little bit. I keep saying live a little bit before all this hard stuff is going to come again, you know. So if I could just have a really nice summer with the boys now and do all the fun things before.
Do you find yourself living a little bit, tiny bit each day?
Yeah, I do. And I feel a bit more like myself, you know. And my friends will say things like, come on now, we'll get the colour done. We'll be like, we don't need to be going around looking like a widow now altogether, you know what I mean? Like, you know, and I remember at the start, I'm like, okay, or, you know, or they'd say like, might be time to take the makeup bag back out, you know. We might put on a bit of foundation, will we, today, you know. So like only for people that will just like lift you up. And, you know, I remember the girls bringing me shopping for clothes, and I remember standing there literally like this, like, and they were like putting clothes on me, but like, that's lovely on you, like, get that jumper. And I remember thinking like, oh my God, I just want to die. And that's how I felt. But they just pick you up and make plans, and yeah, and it's all the little things.
That's really important though, because, you know, even the last podcast that I edited there, actually, it went out this Sunday gone with Alan and Emer.
Yeah.
And they lost a child, and they were talking about that, how a lot of their circle has gone, which is so hard.
That's so hard.
Because like, I'm thinking of all your friends there, and I'm like, and they're bringing a bit of humour, and they're doing it like, and their hearts are broken for you. But like, they don't realise how important that is. And I think what it is they're not scared, and they've faced it, and they're brave to go, we'll get stuck in, like, you know.
And you're included.
She needs us.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Fair play to them.
And like, they'll give you the little push, you know, if you're like, oh, I don't know, sure, listen, just give it a go and see. And even today, like, the amount of messages I got when they knew I was coming in to do this, been like, you've got this, like, and you'll do them proud. And, you know, they just know, like, I am so lucky, like,
I have them.
Yeah.
Do you, you know, when you think of Peter now, do you feel like he's with you still? Do you feel him around you, or do you dream of him?
I feel like he's around me. I get signs all the time.
Do you?
Yeah. And like, he just would not have believed in any of that stuff, you know. But I do, I get signs, and I feel like if I need to make a decision, I feel like he will try to guide me and help me. And my main thing for me was to get the answers. I felt like he needed me to know the answers. And I think that would have been the main thing to him. And I felt like the minute I got the answers, that I remember thinking like, you can have a bit of peace now, you know, because he needed us to know. Is what I felt. But yeah, he's not going anywhere.
Yeah,
he's going to make sure we're all right. And yeah, and whatever that man can do on the other side to make sure we're okay, he is doing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he idolised us. He did. Yeah. And us, him. Yeah.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you today.
You've
really helped me to, well, first of all, you made me lose my life crying over here in the corner.
I'm so sorry.
And then I came without tissues today, like of all days. Like, anyway, I always have them, but I forgot. But yeah, it's unimaginable. And it's so heavy and it's so hard. And there's nothing that will make it any easier for you. I just hope and wish that you can find peace.
That's exactly what I want. Yeah. Just peace.
Peace.
Yeah.
Be able to live peacefully.
Yeah.
And your two little men will mind mommy.
They will. Yeah, they will. They keep me on my toes, anyway, that's for sure. But
listen,
thanks, Kathy.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for asking
Louise.
Me. Thanks, Kathy.
Not at all.
Thank you for tuning into this week's episode. And I just wanted to remind you, if you can, please, can you help spread the word about this podcast? Do all the usual things, follow it, subscribe, whatever it is. What really helps is if you share it on social media. So if you see a clip from this podcast and you feel the urge to share it and tell people that you find it helpful or send it to someone, I really appreciate that. I want to keep this podcast going and these episodes getting out to people. But there's only one way I can do that, and that's if you guys help me. So again, all the usual things, interacting with it, the clips, following me on Spotify, it really helps. Thank you guys, and I'll talk to you all again next week.